not too hard, you can get a feeling, a good feeling of whether your code is converted or not. And we discuss ways of doing so that relies on this assumption that Richardson ansatz works, that, I mean, your solution can be described in terms of continuous functions multiplied by appropriate factors of your discretization length or your control parameter to their some given power. And by understanding how that behaves, you can make sure that your code converges with the right order that the one you expect with respect to the particular discretization you've implemented. And you can even turn that around and use it to your advantage to produce a solution that is even more accurate than the one you are obtaining in principle. I also should say, I want to stress, that we just discussed two very particular discretizations. As we move along, we're going to discuss others and that are more accurate, more flexible, etc. But we wanted to just give you the basic flavor so that you can begin doing your homework, you can understand how to interact with a code, how to even begin to define the numerical problem. And once you know those basic techniques, we're never going to be able to cover all possible techniques out there, but it gives you the basic tools that if you ever want to do a numerical implementation on your own, you know where to start, you know what the language is, you know the right jargon, and you know how to ask the right questions to decide what might be the best strategy for you. But as I said, we're going to keep going and incrementing our knowledge on the basic techniques. But today, I really want to begin to make contact with numerical relativity. So the last thing I wanted to say was that suppose you write your code, you check diligently everything you can to make sure your code is convergent, you're happy with the order of convergence, and even though, and even when you say you wrote a particular order of in your code, you decide to use second order approximations, you see that you get a second order convergence, you still are not totally sure if the solution you're obtaining is the correct one. For instance, suppose you're implementing a particular PDE system. For whatever reason, you mess up in the derivation, and you end up sticking a factor of two where it shouldn't be. Right? Suppose you're iterating this equation. And for whatever reason, let me just imagine that. Remember one particular approximation that we wrote for the derivative of u was to say derivative of u at the point j was uj plus 1 minus uj minus 1 divided by 2 delta x. Suppose in your implementation, you forgot these two. Well, once you put in here, the problem that you're going to be solving will be not this problem, but effectively will be this problem. Right? Because that 2 would simplify the 2 that you're missing. So if you write your code, do your analysis, especially in the periodic boundary condition setup, you're going to see convergence. Your code is going to give you a second order accuracy, but of course you're going to get it. You're going to be getting the wrong solution. So how can we even think of another way or a complementary way to try to understand where your code is actually getting the right solution that you wanted to get? And the concept that we'll introduce is this one, which is that of an independent residual evaluation. And I mean, that's a bunch of words, but at the bottom line is to say the following. So suppose you're dealing with a coworker and your colleague hands you a numerical solution and you don't quite trust this person. So what are you going to do? You're going to take that solution, that numerical solution, and say, well, I believe you, but let me just do something completely independent. I'm going to rewrite the equations that we both were trying to solve. I'm going to get that solution. I'm just going to compute the error or the residual of that problem. Very much like if I told you, I know, the integral of this very complicated function is this, and I hand it to you, the very first thing you'll do is, okay, let me have it. I'm going to take the derivative, and I want to see if it coincides with the thing that we're trying to iterate to begin with. This is exactly the same. And it has some good properties. You're not going to have to worry too much about how you do that discretization. Remember when we discussed that once you are integrating this finite different approximation, you have these errors, and depending on how these errors compound, they might compound in a bad way, and your solution can become useless very quickly. That's because you're using that numerical iteration, or that numerical scheme, to iterate forward in time. Here, we're not going to have to worry about the possible errors compounding in time, because the only thing we want to do with this is just evaluate whether the solution is the right, is the solution to the right problem. So we're just going to use it once, or of every now and then, and we're not going to use it to advance the solution, just to grab the solution that you have obtained or someone else have obtained, and just chug it through some tests and then see if things are okay or not. So let me just basically give you the basics of the idea. Is to say, well, this is the equation we both tried to solve, and someone said, okay, I'm going to create this particular code through finite difference approximations or any other technique. I discretize the operator that defines the equation. I obtain a numerical solution, which I denote by UH, and which was obtained by discretizing this function in this way. So now the only thing that can happen is that, as we said before, someone messed up, say, for instance, in the computation of this L or this F. So how do we go about testing it? Well, we actually do what we essentially said. We kind of take a blind approach and say, well, let me suppose that I can write another discretization to the problem. I'm going to assume that this is exactly the same for simplicity. We're assuming that we're just discretizing that one. But I'm just going to come and say, well, I'm going to change my operator. Let me give you another example here. So in this problem, I'm taking the derivatives this way, using these 3 points to create that derivative. Well, I can do something else. I can write another derivative to the problem that involves these points. I can involve this, that, and that. It might be higher accurate, but I don't care. Or I might want to say, well, I'm going to take your solution, and instead of taking the derivative using these 3 points, I'm going to skip every other point. I'm going to involve this point, and that point. Essentially, anything that is independent of what was done. In fact, we don't even want to see what was done. I just want to know what is the original problem. I introduce a completely different discretization, and I'm just going to evaluate that solution. So if we did this, if we rediscretize our operator, and we do it in a consistent fashion, we're going to have that our discretized operator is the operator we really wanted to have, the one that is defined by our equation, plus a bunch of terms. And again, using Richardson's point, it will be just a bunch of this continuous operator times appropriate factors of H. So now the whole point is to say, well, if you really think you have an equation, a solution to our equation, then again, what you're handing me is something that should behave in this way. It should be equal. This is the solution you're handing me. This should be equal to the function that we really want to obtain, the solution we really want to obtain, plus a bunch of terms that have continuous functions multiplied by some h's. So I get that, and I evaluate independently your solution with my new discretization of L. So if I take UH, the one you hand me, and I evaluate with this my new discretization. So this is what I'm doing. My discretization should approximate the operator I want. Your solution should behave in this way. And once I apply all these operators to your solution, well, the leading term should be L acting on U. But if the solution you obtain is the correct one, that should be 0. And therefore, you should have an error that goes like H squared. And this is something I can compute. If you give me the solution, I can feed it to my independent evaluator and then just check if the solution is satisfied by seeing that this new term or this evaluation goes to 0. Alternatively, you could have messed this up, again, just as a factor of 2. And so what you're obtaining is actually a different solution. Again, drawing from this example, you would be obtaining a solution to something that, that propagates at twice the speed rather than the right speed for this equation. So the solution you'll be obtaining, again, you have a convergent code that is well-behaved, is stable. So what you're obtaining is some discretized solution to a different problem. So let me just rewrite it. The solution as U plus E0, where E0 is what you need to add to U to obtain the solution to the problem you're actually solving, plus a bunch of terms that maybe they go like H or H squared. I don't know, but you can check that. For instance, if you check convergence, that it goes like h squared, so this term wouldn't be there, but you're obtaining some continuous solution plus some error terms. Okay, if you now feed that to the independent residual evaluator, when L acts on U plus E0, well, L of U is 0, but L of E0 is not. So you're going to be obtaining something that has a non-trivial contribution that will not decay or will not decrease to 0 once you reduce your discretization length. So that's a very simple point. Of course, unless you're extraordinarily unlucky, this contribution will be non-negligible and you'll see it. So you hand the solution or someone hands you a solution, you write a completely new discretization, you evaluate it, and then you see if it converges to 0 or not. It's a very simple technique, but it's actually quite useful because, as I said, it could pick up values of 2, etc., that you would have missed. Especially as we see today and tomorrow, once you deal with, say, for Einstein's equations, which is a very complicated system, it's very easy to mess it up. What you could do is use to your advantage symbolic manipulation programs that will just produce a Fortran code at the end. You say, evaluate this god-awful mess. Every time you see a derivative, replace it by some particular combination, and you could be perverse. You could be such that every time you have a derivative, again, you either skip every other point or just use points to the right or points to the left. It doesn't matter. As long as you have a consistent discretization, you can always say, okay, this is my solution, evaluate it and see what happens. So are we clear with this? Again, it's a very minor top point, but it's something that we can use. Now, at the end of the day, we will show we have a code that is stable, is convergent, it converges with the appropriate order, and if I write a completely independent discretization, I get that it also that the error goes to 0, and so I'm pretty confident that my solution is correct. Okay, so now let's change gears, because what we want to discuss now is how you go about writing a system of equations. Let's see if this works. What's going on? Come on. Okay, there we go. Let me just reduce this. It's too short, too small. Is this the right way? Can we see that? No, I don't think we can. Can you see that? No. So let me just keep it this way, and we're going to just be going down. Okay, so what is it that we're trying to do? Now, after having discussed some very basic techniques of how to interact things in time, we want to ask the question, how will we do that for Einstein's equations? But before I do that, let me just illustrate things with a simple point. So any volunteer to tell me how to write Maxwell's equations? Anyone that wants to dictate me Maxwell's equations? I just want to know what pops you first in your head. Auntie, you want to try? Yeah, just. Okay. That's one. Delta DTB. Like that? Right. So this is the monopole. That says that there are no monopoles in electromagnetism. But okay, do you guys know this one? So do you remember B dot is equal to what? There was a curl somewhere. Something similar to E, and we also have if E, let's imagine that we are in a case where we have no charges, no currents, So we have a zero, and then we don't have to put a current in those equations. Okay, so this is something that we're going to talk about, this kind of these equations or the consequence of this, but let's for the moment ignore these two. So this tells us very much like what we've been discussing. If you know E and you know B, you can go to the future and obtain B and E by perhaps a very similar iteration to the one we've been doing, except that we have to do it for higher dimensions because in that case we're just 1D. But this is a well-defined problem. It's a well-defined problem in the sense that if you know this, the electric and magnetic fields at this given moment, you can ask the question, it makes sense to ask the question, what's going to happen with the fields a few minutes from now? This is one way of writing Maxwell's equations. There is another way. Let me just write it. Have you guys seen this one? Okay. So where is the time derivative here? If I can't do this instead of that one, how do you integrate that with time? You don't have the recipe. It's not written. It's not obvious how you're going to, from here, say, oh, if I give you this state of the field at this given time, I can go forward in this way. It's not too difficult to do it because, okay, we can say, well, I'm going to introduce coordinates where one of the coordinates is time, and I can rewrite this in such a way that dt is equal to something. Oh, but it's still not very well defined because then I have to relate these components of FAV. But if I work, I mean, perhaps a few hours, maybe an hour or so, I can write something. And now it looks like a structure of time derivative of something equal to something else. Which one? So there is the one with respect to the vector potential? Yeah, you can do that. But then you have to work, you do some work to render into something that is a time derivative of something equal to something else that is well defined. Okay, so now let me compare it with Einstein's equations. And say, okay, where the heck is the time derivative here? Einstein's equations say, or general relativity say, well, given a manifold, let me just draw the manifold this way. Play the note with M. Let's have some given topology. The solution of Einstein's equation is the metric GAB that lives on this manifold and determines all, so M is a collection of all possible events in the space-time, and GAB relates those events and the distance, and we can use it to take distances in between them, compute curvature, compute anything that we care about. But, and that GAB is determined by this equation, and it says that all along this spacetime, there is this metric tensor GAB that satisfies that equation and determine what's going on with the events in this manifold. It's not particularly well suited to say, oh, I know the spacetime here, or I know how things are behaving in this way, I can predict what happens at a later time. That information has to be dug out from this equation. And we want to do it in the most general form. We could perhaps say, well, I'm going to introduce coordinates T, X, Y, Z, and I'm going to work hard because I know what's in here, in particular, is the Ricci tensor. And if I write it in a particular set of coordinates, I can then write from here perhaps something that has the second time derivative of the metric equal to something else, and then use that to iterate. But that ties us directly into a particular coordinate system. We know that in general relativity, there is no a priori well-defined coordinate system. So how are we going to go about doing it? So in the 60s, 70s and 80s, people work hard to introduce this kind of way of understanding the problem. If we know something at some given instant of time, we can obtain what's going to happen at later instant of time. In something that was termed geometrodynamics. You know, the geometry of something at a given time, you want to know what the geometry will be at some later time. So the kind of things we're going to discuss now is how you go about doing that. We're going to introduce a number of concepts. In doing so, we're going to turn this beautiful equation into something that is ugly but practical, in that we're going to introduce a way to split this up into a set of equations that tell us given the state of the system at some given time, we can tell what's going to happen afterwards. But given that we're going to give away with writing this beautifully written equation, we don't want to give away the house. We want to maintain as much as we can the geometrical concepts and geometrical intuition of what the equations are telling us. And that will involve introducing several concepts that are useful here for, say, for numerical relativity applications, but it's important in general. For instance, the concepts of ADS, CFT, a lot of the things we introduce will be very natural there because we're going to be trying to induce something on a particular surface that lives in our space-time, and the kind of concepts we introduce there also are natural there. And in general, this discussion, how to turn these equations that are covariant to begin with into something that now has a prescription of evolution in time, will be useful regardless of what we do, as long as we're dealing with the covariant theory. We all, one way or another, we're going to have to go through this kind of the similar steps. So some particular references here. So we have some handwritten notes, and then we have ours that are typed. They are quite verbose, so all the details are supposed to be there. So there's something also you can follow on your own. But so I'm going to make sure we stress the main points. So depending on which particular source you read, they take slightly different conventions on how to do it. But in all, kind of it's the same essence in all of them. So Jimmy York, in some sense, was someone who worked the most in this area. There is a beautiful summary work that he wrote in a book edited by Larry Smarr. I have the book. If anyone is interested, I can lend it to you. Bob Wall, in the book General Relativity and the Gravitation book, in the appendix has quite a bit of it, but in Bob's way, it's very elegant and condensed, so it might be a bit too dense.
Are you saying that we're going to solve this problem thing with like some method that doesn't use coordinates or something?
We're gonna introduce coordinates, but they're gonna be done in a geometrical way, so it's gonna be very, very free. So we're going to capture the essence of the equivalent concept of introducing coordinates so as to define the time evolution. We're going to do it in the most geometrical way possible that will allow us to see the structure of something evolving in time, but remain all the freedom that we know we should have coming from general relativity. You'll see how it comes out. And if you haven't seen this, so we're going to go slow. Just ask me any questions you want because you may have in your minds, because it's something that is in some sense it's unnatural when you first see it, but then it becomes very transparent. The other reference is the MTW book by Mr. Thorne and Wheeler. This description is in MTW. But anyway, so we'll go through it and you'll see how would these things come about. So I'm just saying this generalities, this is what we just said. So we want to start with that system of equations, and we want to end up with something that tells us this structure, that hidden in that equation, we can recognize the structure of the making sense of the concept of what is the geometry now, what's going to happen with that geometry at a later time. So for that, we're going to appeal to our intuition, because after all, the reason we're doing it in this way is because we have built through hundreds of years the intuition of what is the state of the system now, and we want to obtain a recipe to go to the future. So Einstein worked very hard to try to give away with the concept of space and time being different, putting everything together. We now want to go in the opposite direction. We want to start with the space-time being the same entity. We want to forcefully define something that will give us this is the space, this is time. So we're going to have in the back of our minds that we have this manifold. But in this manifold, we want to define a series of hypersurfaces in a very general way. And the only thing we're going to require is that these hypersurfaces are all space-like. So we're going to imagine that we have the manifold M, and that the manifold M, or a subset of the manifold M, can be foliated with a sequence of space like hypersurfaces sigma. And because it's a sequence, I'm going to label those sequences with some parameter t. So here's where we're first doing this thing. We're introducing a concept of time. And it's implicit in our requirement that this space, like at any given time that we fix, we have one given hypersurface, and that hypersurface is purely space-like, right? Do you know the concept of when a hypersurface is space-like, time-like, or null? Right, so, okay, if we look at the normal of it, the normal would be time-like. These, so points, arbitrary points in this hypersurface are related by a space-like distance. We're going to use also, to fix our notations, we're going to use a signature minus plus plus plus, so minus for time, and plus for anything that is in space. And what we're doing, as I said, is changing the point of view of space-time being a single entity to the space-time being composed as this time history of the behavior of these space-like hypersurfaces. And we'll try to retain as much as we can the freedom that we know should be there because we're dealing with general relativity. We're now forcefully introducing this distinction between the manifold and events in the manifold and the sub-manifolds, these slices sigma, we are going to try to make distinction. We're going to make the distinction between events that take place only at the hypersurface, things that are just restricted to live at a given hypersurface, and things that belong to the full spacetime. So we're going to use Greek indices or Latin indices beginning part of the alphabet to range from 0 to 3, 0 being our time label. And we're going to use Latin integers that are in the middle of, say, the alphabet to just have values on integer values, non-zero values, which will then denote these are just purely space coordinates or space-related things that live at particular hypersurfaces. Okay, so now we want to coordinatize things. We want to make sense of, okay, if I have this point here, I want to give it some coordinates. So we already said that we're given one particular label, which we call t, at each one of these hypersurfaces. So we're going to use that point, let me call it point P, has at least here a coordinate t. So since I have that handy, I might as well just use it. We are completely free to give assign the coordinates of that guy. So it could be the origin, it could be x equal 3 meters, y equal 2, and z equal 0. So let me just introduce those coordinates xi, which are totally free. There's no one that determines what those are for us. So we now want to say, well, for the moment, we're going to assume that we have this matrix GAB for the full spacetime. And from there, we want to make sense of the metric of each individual slice and how they relate as you go up in time through the dynamics of Einstein's equations. So intrinsic to this hypersurface, we're going to say that there is a metric Gij, and if we want to be very careful in places where it's not obvious, we're going to stick a supra-index with a 4 to denote this is for the full 4 spacetime, and this 3 to the full each one of these hypersurfaces. Again, there is nothing special about 4 dimensions. I'm just using 4 dimensions for the derivation. Going to arbitrary directions is completely analogous. So we could be starting with a 5-dimensional manifold. So then we'll have a 5 here, and then we use a 4 here for the intrinsic metric at any given time. And I'm using already the notation. Sorry, let me just change it to mu nu. So this is in full space time. This is just in the space-like hypersurface. Okay, so now that's, say we are at a given hypersurface. But we said we wanted to relay things at a given hypersurface and what happens afterwards through its evolution. So we need to now make sense of what happens between this hypersurface and, say, the next one. So given a completely arbitrary hypersurface, the only thing we're requiring is to be space-like, how do we begin to even relate points from here to there? It's not a priori obvious. The two hypersurfaces are distinct. There is some distance in between the two of them. The only thing that I can invariantly make sense of is the normal of this hypersurface. Right? That is defined as just simply saying, if I'm assuming that I have this metric, I can take the derivative of this coordinate t that I'm using to define this hypersurface. Remember, each hypersurface has had it labeled t, which means we're defined by one of these, a particular value, constant value for each one of these t's. So gradient of t defines a vector that is normal to it. And we're going to call it Na. This is a covector that is normal to the hypersurface, just as the standard way. So at least I can make sense of this n that goes up. And I also, given that I have a vector, I can raise it and lower with the metric. I'm sorry, I'm going to keep changing this notation. Mu. Yes? Cool. I mean, we're going to get there because this freedom of how you're going to do it, we're going to have to dig it out. We want to see it explicitly. And then depending on the particular application we may be thinking about, different options will be better. But first we want to lay down the formal way that captures all the freedom we have in as clear geometrical sense as we can. And then from there we'll go on to the next step. At the moment we just want to write down the basic structure that we could use in principle. So associated to this, we can also define a vector, n mu, that is just the inverse of that one, the dual to that covector. But we're going to ask one more thing. We're going to ask this vector, this normal vector, to be normalized. So we're going to define, or we're going to multiply here by some appropriate factor, which will come in, which later we'll see precisely what that factor is, so that this is satisfied. And nu is equal to minus 1, which we know it should be satisfied. We knew it should be negative because the space-like this hypersurface is space-like. So at least now we have defined a way to get out of the one particular hypersurface onto the next one. We could follow the normal straight up until we meet the next hypersurface. So that's one way, but we could quickly run into trouble because of the following. Suppose, for whatever reason, your hypersurface, you didn't know this, but it was curved in this way. It was curved in this way because maybe we have a strongly gravitating object here that you define things in a particular way that ended up curving the hypersurface in this particular direction. Again, how to define these hypersurfaces in a way that is convenient for the particular application will be something we're going to worry about in a strong way. But at the moment, we're just keeping it general. So suppose you say, well, I have that hypersurface, and I have the next one being like that, for whatever reason, and I'm going to say, I'm going to get to the next hypersurface by following the normal direction. Okay, so if I follow the normal direction, say here, I end up there. That's fine. The normal here is, say, it's pointing in that direction, I end up there. But it could be in a situation where if I follow the normal, okay, this one will be there. If I follow the normal here, it will be there. Now I'm in trouble because I started with two points that had different coordinates. And now they meet in the middle and they have a coordinate singularity. The coordinates were bad there. So we want to have more freedom in how we assign the coordinates on the next hypersurface with respect to the coordinates that we had in the previous hypersurface. That freedom will be encased or will be encoded in some other vector that we're going to introduce, which is going to be graphically or intuitively defined in this way. we're going to say the following. So suppose at some given hypersurface, we pick a given point, say this point P that we defined here. We said we're going to assign, we might as well assign the time coordinate to that point given by the time label that we have for that particular hypersurface. And we're going to follow, we're going to arbitrarily define the coordinates that that point has. And we're going to follow the following construction. We're going to say, go up along the direction of the normal. And you might have to go some distance to, say, the right or in any particular direction. And we're going to define the same coordinates that we defined for that point to that point. And we're free to label them, to give any label that we want. Let me just give it, define x star here. We're going to say that at this one, we're going to also give it the same x star coordinates labels. We're totally free to give this. And better yet, we're not saying anything about this shift. And this is the reason why this vector is called a shift vector. We are saying nothing about how far this point can be. It could be extremely far. It could be that the curve that joins the point here with the point there is space-like. We're not asking any particular condition about this at this very moment. We're just saying, go to pick that point arbitrarily if you want on the next hypersurface. Define it to have those given coordinates, the same coordinates as you gave here. Go up along the normal direction, and then the distance between that point that you get as going from one given point up the normal direction to the point that you actually assign exactly the same coordinate labels, that's going to be given by this beta dt. Right? And we define it with beta dt because we want to disentangle how far these two hypersurfaces are with this vector. We normalize, remember, this vector. So we're going to introduce this other function, which we'll call the lapse, because it's going to be saying the following. So suppose these two hypersurfaces have two different labels that we know that's what we should have, because each hypersurface is labeled with a different value. So this one is t, this one is t plus delta t. The difference in label is delta t. But again, the difference in label is just a label, right? So there is nothing intrinsically well-defined about it. So what we could do is to say, well, okay, something at least geometrically that we can make sense is, as you go up in the normal direction, which we know is a time-like trajectory, you can always compute the proper length, the proper time of that curve from this point to that point. And then we say, well, the proper time will be given by delta t times the value of this, or times a number, and that number we're going to call it the lapse. And for obvious reasons, it's called the lapse because it tells you the elapsed time in between one hypersurface and the next. And now is we're going to do the splitting between this point. Now let me pick a different point. I'm going to call this point, say, Q. It's a different point. I'm going to call this point P prime because it's the point that has exactly the same space level labels as the point P in the previous hypersurface, and the only difference is in the time label, which is t plus delta t, because we're in two different hypersurfaces. Let me look at a different point, let's call it Q, that belongs to the new hypersurface, that, and therefore its time label is t plus delta t. And let's imagine that the distance between, the labels we give between this point and that point, because we're choosing this point to be sufficiently close, is going to be just this label xi star plus this a small distance delta xi. Are we clear with the basic stuff that we're introducing? And now we're going to say, well, let's compute the distance between that point and that point. The distance between these two points, are, of course, we're assuming that the hypersurfaces are sufficiently close to each other, will be, from the four-dimensional point of view, will just be given by right, dx mu, dx nu, without making any particular distinction between what we are labeling with time, what we're labeling with space. So that's the standard way of seeing this distance. But now we want to introduce this splitting. And we can, doesn't take a long time to convince oneself, let me just go back, to say that, okay, now this distance can be written in this new way of seeing things as the distance we traverse as we go up. Remember, the signature is minus plus plus plus. So if the proper time, so we can always say the distance, the full distance is the proper minus the proper time plus the proper distance in space. And that's precisely what we're saying here. The proper time difference between the two slices is minus alpha squared dt squared. That's how we define this alpha. And the proper distance between this point, which is the one we get as we go straight up, and that point, which is the Q point, is this distance, or the contribution to the distance due to this dQ, delta x, sorry. But we also have to add this contribution with beta i delta t. And so here we're saying it's the amount with a minus sign of distance along the time direction, or the time, the normal direction, sorry, plus the amount of distance in space, which is whatever metric we have, right, in this hypersurface, times the full distance between the two points, or the full coordinate distance between the two points, which is dxi plus beta i dt squared. And now it is just a matter of perhaps what you find convenient. You might say, well, let me put things together, everything that has t squared, everything that has cross terms, and everything that has just purely space intervals. And so therefore, we can rewrite this ds squared as this thing, minus alpha squared gij beta I beta j dt squared plus twice gij beta I dxj dt plus gij, this one. And the useful thing is that now we see explicitly, in terms of specially defined functions, the freedom that we have to choose coordinates. We always knew, in, say, in four dimensions, that we could choose four coordinates completely arbitrarily. Here we have turned those four functions into special concepts. And those four functions is the alpha and the beta. So there are 3 degrees of freedom in beta and one degree of freedom in alpha. And if you say, I've given those by hand, say, if you define them completely by hand, you see that the only piece of quote-unquote free information or dynamics, or the only piece that might contain any dynamics, has to be hidden in this gij, which is now a six-dimensional there are 6 free components that are encoded there. And so that's a natural thing. In the four-dimensional point of view, you had 10 pieces of information to give with three pieces of free things you could define. Here, you have the 6 pieces explicitly out, and everything else that you could define by hand is already taken care of. Of course, we haven't given away that freedom. We're just encoding that freedom in special function, the lapse and the shift. Depending on the particular situation at hand, we might want to choose the lapse and shift in particular ways. So let me just stress what we said. So the lapse and shift are these special functions, one that essentially, or gives precisely, the proper distance in between two neighboring slices if you go along from one point along the normal to the next hypersurface. And shift, and this vector beta, which is called the shift vector, which is describes how you shift in a given slice to get to the other point, or the point that has the same labels with respect to the one you get to by going along the normal. Okay, so it's just more words the same. So this is where we're going now. So we now have found a particularly appealing way of encoding of re-encoding the original information of the four-dimensional metric as something that is intrinsically three-dimensional plus some other functions. So we want to now exploit that that observation to our advantage. So the one thing we're going to say is, okay, each hypersurface, each one of these sigmas, it's a true manifold in its own sense. This is just one dimension and lower. So given that, I'm assuming that the metric on that hypersurface, on each one of the hypersurfaces given by Gij, anything that we knew that we could do with the four-dimensional metric, we can do it as well with the three-dimensional metric, except that just recalling that we're in one dimension less than the other one. So we knew that in the four-dimensional metric, G had its inverse. Well, the same thing will happen with the three-dimensional metric. So Gij, Gjk is delta I, k. And we're going to be using this way of writing the metric, therefore, which is the one we just discussed. But of course, we know that this ds squared, written in terms of purely of quantities that are either freely specifiable or the true metric intrinsic to each one of these hypersurfaces, is also equal to the four-dimensional way of seeing the problem. So we have this kind of mapping in between the four-dimensional metric and this one by just looking at components by components. So the first thing we notice is the following. The four-dimensional metric, if we chose the purely special components, it's equal to the three-dimensional metric just directly. So every time we have a four-dimensional metric with the indexes down, and that's important, with the covariant expression of the metric, the four metric, is purely special components are given just by the intrinsic three metric on each one of these hypersurfaces. And this is a general property. So I just want to stress this. We can convince, and we'll convince ourselves by doing explicit calculations. But every time you have a tensor, any general tensor in the full manifold with respect to the four-dimensional coordinates, if you just look at the special components, they are equal to the analog special components on the intrinsic hypersurface. We're going to discuss more about this. But that's only valid if you're looking for the covariant components. If you have mixed components or fully contravariant components, that doesn't apply. We'll discuss this later, but let me just first define this. So given the metric that we just wrote, we also can make sense of the inverse metric. And this inverse metric can be written, I mean, you can compute it explicitly, is to show, on this, I leave it as an exercise, you can see this, that the G00 with the indices up is minus 1 divided by alpha squared. That's useful because remember we said that we wanted to have this n to be such that it's newly normalized. Okay, the number that enters here is precisely alpha. So we know that then n mu is going to be alpha grad mu of t, or also alpha 0, 0, 0. The cross components, the components that have time and something else in space, is this. And notice that the three-dimensional induced metric, or the three-dimensional piece of the full metric, the one that has purely special components, is not just the three-dimensional intrinsic metric. It has these components as well. So this is just to make a point that if you're looking at the contravariant components, it's not of the full metric is not the same, or any tensor is not the same as the one for the induced one on the slice. A few other useful concepts that we'll use a lot more as we go along. You can compute the determinant of the metric, of the full metric, and what you find is that there is a very convenient relation between the determinant of the full metric and the determinant of the 3 metric is just related by the alpha. So that will come in handy as we do try to express some particular equations in a way that is now purely related to quantities on the hypersurface. Okay, so this normal vector is essentially the discussions we just made, and the point here is just to stress. Oops, sorry. Ouch. That. The n mu, well, here, I have a minus sign. Let me just put a minus sign there. The reason we put a minus sign there is because g 0, 0 was minus 1 divided by alpha squared. And we just want to have a vector so that n 0 is positive, so that we go along the flow to the future, not to the past. But it's just a convenient freedom that we are fixing. So the vector n has minus alpha seated in the time slot and zeros in the space slots. And then if you erase it, you have 1 divided by alpha in the time slot and minus beta divided by alpha in the space slot. Okay, so now what we are doing, so let me just try to stress this, is we have split our initial manifold that was complete, that was not, that did not make any distinction between space and time. We have now introduced a very specific distinction between space and time. And everything seems to be telling us that we could rewrite everything that matters with respect to the metric that is intrinsic to the hypersurfaces. But we instinctively know that there has to be something else. So if I have this flat sheet here embedded in this three-dimensional space that is this room, I know that the metric on this slice is purely flat. So distance here are taken with the Euclidean hypersurface, with the Euclidean metric that corresponds to just flat. But just the knowledge of that doesn't tell me where this slice is embedded in this three-dimensional manifold in this way, that way, that way. So there has to be something else that tells us how this metric, this surface is embedded. So there is some extra concept that we have to introduce. And that's in concept of extrinsic curvature. This is what it will tell us where this hypersurface is embedded in different ways in this larger, in the one extra dimension manifold. So we now have to introduce that, define it properly, and this is what we're going to stop here. Right when we finish this discussion. Okay, so we want to find what is the right concept that encodes this information, that this hypersurface is actually not its own, but it's embedded in this higher dimensional space. So this is just that discussion we just did. So let us introduce first some definition, and then we'll make sense of it. Suppose I define the following tensor, which I'm going to call it K. It's going to be a purely spatial tensor, so it's something that lives on the hypersurface. So it has indices with Latin in the middle of the alphabet. I'm going to define it with minus the gradient, and this is the full gradient. This is the gradient of the full metric GAB, but we are thinking about indices that are covariant, so I'm only just picking the space part of it. I'm only picking the space part of the n, and I want to see how that, what that gives us. Well, the first thing is, why do we even care about looking about this one? So we're looking at the gradient of the vector n. That's precisely, again, intuitively now, what it's going to tell us where this flat, this sheet is like this, or is like that. The normal of this one, they all are vectors that are lined up with respect to each other and remain lined up with respect to each other. But if I'm now considering this surface, the metric is still, the intrinsic metric hasn't changed. I haven't done anything with the flat sheet. But if I look at the normal, this one is pointing that way, that one is pointing that way, and they form a divergent congruence. And if I do the opposite, they form a convergent congruence. So So that's the reason why we at least have the gut feeling that this may be the right quantity to tell us where things are embedded in one way or another. We're also going to be able to prove, and this is rather straightforward, that this is symmetric. That is, if I exchange J and I get exactly the same value. That we'll use and will come handy later. But let's just discuss this simple point. Let us kind of, in a way, brute forcefully now compute precisely what that contribution would be. Okay, so we have the derivative, the covariant derivative of a covector. We know precisely how that is supposed to be done. It's a partial derivative of the vector, and then a contribution due to the Christoffel symbols that tells us where we're in a curved space time or not, and or with particular coordinates. So because it's a covariant vector, we need to take a minus sign and then this particular combination. But now we're going to use that this n is not any n, but the n that we define that has only a time component, and that time component is minus alpha. So this term will contribute with nothing because there is no component of n in the space directions. So this one goes away. We only need to worry about that guy. Again, but this guy only has a component in time, so this one we have to have it only non-zero if that component is zero, which then says that mu here will be gamma zero. So grad I of nj is equal to alpha, where we absorb the minus sign in front of the n, or minus alpha with this one. Alpha, the Christoffel symbol corresponding to the four-dimensional metric, the full metric, gamma zero ij. Okay, so now we have to write down what that is, and we can do it in different ways, depending on what is it that you remember, which formula you remember, the Christoffel with index up or the Christoffel with index down. Either way, if you evaluate what that is, you're going to get this. Alpha is the last function. Yes. And it's the one that we use to calculate the proper time along the normal direction from a given point to the point where we intersect the next hypersurface. And this n is abnormal. And because we ask it to be normalized, to have unit normal, then we have to take this minus alpha. Because remember the metric, the full metric g00 with the index up is minus 1 divided by alpha squared. We could define this n with a 1 here, but then it wouldn't be normalized. This term?
Yeah.
Right, because this n has no, when the index down, has no, yes, or no special component. Okay, so now once we write down what this is, it's going to be 1/2, and it has several contributions from the metric. And the one I really want to look at, this one has derivative of the metric. But notice what derivative it has of these g0i's and g0j's. What did we have in G0i and G0j was a beta, was a shift, right? So let me just go up for kind of few transparencies to remind you. Ow. Stop. Well. Remember, from the full four-dimensional metric, G0i and G0j only have the shift. Right, which is something that we define by hand. It's something that shouldn't have any particular information because it's something that relevant physical information because something that is completely free. So let's just look at the other. We went too far. So let's look at this one. We said these are just gradient of freely specifiable functions, the shift vector. So the one that truly has some information is this Gij. This is the intrinsic metric of the hypersurface. Comma zero, that's comma time. So let me ignore this for the time being, because for the argument it doesn't matter. This Kij, the way we have defined, is minus 1 divided by 2 alpha times the time derivative of Gij. So this is the one that tells us, in a way, is the rate of change of this metric, induced metric Gij, in between two neighboring hypersurfaces. So vectorially, again, if I'm thinking about this hypersurface, and I have next to it, I have another one, and another one there, how this Gij changes as we go up and down in the time direction, that's precisely the information that is contained in Kij. And this is, so from a geometrical point of view, is how this normal, the congruence of normals emanating from the hypersurface would behave, tell us how we're embedding this hypersurface in the higher dimensional picture. Or from kind of a practical point of view, it tells us how this intrinsic metric is, what's the rate of change of this intrinsic metric as seen from the full dimensional, the full four dimensional point of view. And we'll be able to make good sense. I mean, this we can do up to some extra terms that we can add there that are like this, that don't have really true dynamical information. We can make good sense of this Gij and this Kij as momenta and conjugate momenta in a Hamiltonian redefinition of Einstein's equations. And this is what is used, for instance, as a starting point in many of the derivations of quantum theory or approaches to quantum theory of gravity. You just try to quantize Gij or the behavior of Gij and Kij in a particular way, and this would be like the P and this would be like the Q in your standard harmonic oscillator, though in this case we're in a much more complicated scenario. But I will ask you to do, so this is kind of the basic now infrastructure that we are developing. We have now split our spacetime in terms of space-like hypersurfaces. We have now the intuitive feeling, and this is what we're going to have to formalize tomorrow, that we could reinterpret everything that we knew from the full four-dimensional point of view in terms of new concepts, the intrinsic metric to each hypersurface, how each hypersurface is embedded in the full four-dimensional point of view. We have made sense or tied the coordinate freedom to four functions that we can introduce by hand. And what we'll see tomorrow is that Einstein's equations can be recast in a particular way that will tell us how the intrinsic metric of this hypersurface and the extrinsic metric of the hypersurface will vary in time once we impose Einstein's equations. And that's what we're doing tomorrow. And you'll see now what will the connection be between, say, these Maxwell's equations written in fully covariant form and how you end up writing your familiar E dot and B dot equations. And we'll also have an analogy with the constraints, the dB equals zero and dB equals zero, say, in the absence of charges and current. But let me then stop here, otherwise I'm going to be going too far. So if you can, try to read through this. I mean, as I said, the notes are very verbose. You might have seen that every single step is described, but that's the point. Usually you don't find things in any of those references. A lot of steps are kind of missing just because, well, the author thinks are obvious, but everything is spelled out in here. And there is actually a typo. So there is actually, this is true. There is a 20 buck reward for the one of you that finds what the mistake is. And of course, we're not saying who the person is that found it, because in his webpage, he actually points this out. So either you try to do the calculations or you exploit Google to your advantage, one way or the other, you're going to find what the error is. Okay.